خوشنودی امام زمان را بلندتر سالوا
اعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله ناصر المستضعفين وقاهر المستكبرين وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله القاهر فوق عباده وأشهد أن سيدنا وحبيب قلوبنا محمدا صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
عبده ورسوله وإن يكاد الذين كفروا ليزلقونك بأبصارهم لما سمعوا الذكر ويقولون إنه لمجنون وما هو إلا ذكر للعالمين. Brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I would like to begin by thanking you personally for being here this evening. I'm sure some of you may have had other preferences and may have had other priorities. So whatever you sacrificed this evening for being here, al-awabu and Allah. Allah will compensate you for that. I would like to also be more specific and thank the brothers and or sisters who were participating and putting this program together. And in particular, the management of the Islamic Center here and the resident alim for allowing and permitting what seems like a rare occasion nowadays to have what used to be normal procedure 20 and 25 years ago, which is a echo of what Brother Sheikh Hashim said concerning how the voices have grown faint when it comes to the blessed memory of the late Al-Imam Al-Khomeini, Qaddasallahu Sirrah. I sort of received a little feedback, and initially coming to speak exclusively for the full time that I have about the late Imam, it seems like some of you would like to hear a little about the Prophet's time, the Prophet's lifetime, the Prophet's seerah, and others would like to hear a little about what may be called Zionist Muslims today. So taking that into consideration, I will try to maybe amalgamate these three components together, and hopefully after it is all said and done, we will have contributed in a brotherly but frank way about the information about these three segments of the presentation. First of all, we all agree and affirm that the Prophet of Allah is our uswa. Obviously, the ayah is very well stated, well beyond any human being's ability to state it. لقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة لمن كان يرجو الله واليوم الآخر وذكر الله كثيرا. Indeed, you have in the messenger of Allah a behavioral model for those who are seeking Allah in the final day, and those who remain conscious of Allah, remain perpetually, always, with a multiplicity conscious of Allah. وَذَكَرَ اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا. Now, obviously, we have a certain, almost routine way of presenting the Prophet's lifetime. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his. I'm going to try.
Salawat.
I'm going to try to state the facts as I know them, but I'm going to do it in what may be a new light to you. In other words, you probably haven't heard this before. And this is what we need. This is what we need. We need to understand more closely and more movingly what our beloved Prophet went through, and make the transition from there to understand what Imam al-Khomeini also went through, and make the transition from there to understand where we are. When the Prophet of Allah, alayhi wa alihi salatu wa salam, when he came to this world, obviously we all know he came to a scattered amount of people who were living on the desert sands of Arabia. He came to human nature. He wasn't coming to people who were somewhat superhuman or somewhat subhuman. He's come to human nature as it is. Of course, this part of the world was withdrawn from the hustle and bustle of the surrounding, what is called civilized or modernized parts of the world. That's in reference to Egyptian civilization, Persian civilization, and Byzantine or Roman civilization, or Greek, as it was called. It was a fringe area of the Arabian Peninsula that was in the margins of these surrounding civilizations. The Prophet came to these people. Okay, let's take somewhat of a closer look at who these people were to understand what the Prophet had to put up with. These people were called the Arabians, and they had their culture, they had their religious hierarchy, they had their commercial enterprise, as unsophisticated as it may have been, because remember, once again, they were not in the middle of a cosmopolitan, flourishing, expanding part of the world. It was the ho-hum of the Arabian desert. He came to these people with a radical message, something that blew their minds and had the potential to blow away their way of life and their culture. The people have a culture. They had their culture. Other peoples of the time had their culture. Ever since then, we had societies who have their culture. And today, we have cultures. There's a cultural issue. But when the Prophet of Allah, who is teaching us, that's how we are supposed to understand the relationship in one of its aspects. When he came to this culture, he didn't immediately defy the culture. He didn't take issue with the people and the way that they were carrying on in their everyday life. One, and it wasn't only the last prophet who did this, it was all the prophets of Allah. When they spoke to the people, their own people, they said, Ya Qawmi, my people. So here is where the prophet was working on a medium of communication that was not hostile, trying to work on what was common between him and his own people, meaning on this cultural norm that he knew he's coming to dismantle. And at first, the people just listened. But then when they sensed how radical or revolutionary, this is also has become an endangered word. Not many people use the word revolutionary any longer. It's been just a few years. We're not talking about eons of time. A few years, what happened? The word loses its usage. The Prophet came with a radical and a revolutionary message, but one that understood human nature. The society in Mecca, in which he was born and to which he was speaking, was a society that had its hierarchy. And all of that hierarchy put together was called Quraysh. And when these chieftains of Quraysh, they understood exactly what this person, the son of Abdullah by the name of Muhammad, was talking about, then the opposition began. We know the Prophet spent 23 years in his revolutionary struggle to replace this system of Quraysh with a system that has come from Allah. The details therein, I think any average Muslim, I'm sorry, the younger ones here, maybe may not know these details, and I don't mean to offend the younger ones or to speak beyond them, but if they ask you questions later on in the week or the month or the year, help them out with this part. The Prophet of Allah spent 23 years in an ongoing struggle in which the contradictions between him and his own people caused him to change his speech from saying, Ya Qawmi, and having the Qur'an describe them as kuffar and mushrikeen. This is a very strong opposition that was shown to the Prophet, and it didn't go away. You see, what we should learn from history is cultures, the Prophet of Allah managed to deculturize these people who became Muslims, but their own culture went underground. And here is where some of you should have a sense of understanding this history maybe better than other Muslims, simply because other Muslims don't dwell on it very much. And that's to their own loss. Because what would happen in the 30 years after the Prophet passes on, the culture that was subdued in Mecca came back. It came back with, this time, with the political control of things. It didn't come back with its pre-Islamic idiom or its Jahili values. No. It had deep Islamic cover. These people who came back with the pre-Islamic political and economic culture, this time they came back, but they were wearing the Islamic attire. They were giving khutbas. They were leading the prayers. I'll take here a page out of our history books and remind you that Imam Ali alayhi salam had to deal with this released time reaction, because when he was struggling against the usurpers of power represented by Bani Umayyah, when he was dealing with them, he was also dealing with his own power base, who began to show symptoms of yearning for that culture. These are those who are called in the books of history Shi'atu Ali. They themselves began to question, wait a minute here. I mean, they fought the wars that were fought by the Imam to withhold this cultural comeback or bursting out were what is called in today's language civil wars. The Muslims had civil wars. But I want to remind some of us, not all of us, I don't know you personally, some of you I know, very dear brothers and all, but as an assembly of people here, please accept this coming from a brother. Imam Ali had to contend not only with those who were threatening with military force and with the armies they had in Sham, but he was dealing now with a public opinion that it was feeling that the tide is turning against you. Why can't you have a feeling for the future? And why can't you join this tide? And if you are not versed on history, and unfortunately, maybe some of you who commemorate Ashura and Karbala, and you miss out on what went into the making of Ashura and Karbala. Some of you should know that in this southern Iraqi context of pro-Imam Ali population base, there were those who went through this civil war. They went to Al-Jamal and they sustained the casualties and the sacrifices from this battle. Then they went to Siffin and they sustained the casualties and sacrifices at Siffin. Now these were their own people. We're talking about families against families, relatives against relatives. And we were not talking about hate. Even though they went to the war front in their disagreement, they didn't hate each other. This element of hate that some people have against other Muslims, even though the issues may take them to the war front, was absent. How do we justify its presence when we sense it in some people around? It's ignorance. They don't even know their own history. And then there was Al-Nahrawan. In Al-Nahrawan also, these were, I'm going to use this word, it doesn't fit here, but this is what some people would call today, these were the hyper-revolutionary Muslims. Meaning, they were more pro-Ali than Ali himself. And they were the ones who turned against him. This is part of our historical personality. If we don't know this, we don't know who we are. And unfortunately, many times if you go to commemorating certain issues, occasions, birth dates, battles, wars, all of this knowledge is absent. If this required knowledge is absent, if we are a continuity, if this is a continuum of who we were, who we transited into, and who we are today, if this is absent, so I ask you, why are you commemorating Karbala and Ashura when you don't even know the roots of Karbala and Ashura? Abdullah ibn Abbas, who was the colleague, the companion, the confidant, and the comrade in arms of an Imam Ali, when he saw that the tide was turning against this Imam of justice, he took 6 million dirhams from the Basra treasury and he went to Mecca. This was the person who had fought with sincerity, with sacrifice, with no questions, up until that last minute when he, in his own mind, realized that this is not in the favor of the Imam. This whole issue was not in favor of the Imam, so now he's willing to take this money and to go to Mecca and not be involved in any of this. You see, we're dealing with human beings. Allah and His Prophet were dealing with human nature, with the propensity to do what is right and the propensity to do what is wrong. وَنَفْسٍ وَمَا سَوَّاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا وَقَدْ خَابَ مَنْ دَسَّاهَا. We're dealing with human beings. The human being, human nature hasn't changed. Of course, we have a lot of material things around us that have changed. We no longer have the camel and the horse. Now we have the airplane and the train. A lot of things in the material world have changed. But our human nature, it didn't change. We still carry the same human nature that was there then, that is here now. People at that time, when Uthman became the third successor to the Prophet, to make the highest decisions for the Muslims, he opened up the policies that were there before him. Abu Bakr and Umar had told the people of Mecca and Medina, you don't go outside to these other lands. You stay where you are. When Uthman came, he said, no, who says you have to stay where you are? You go wherever you want to go. Go! And they went. They went to these rich areas, and now they got a taste of what it is to be rich. Now they felt the affluence that they didn't feel before. And inside Muslim society, there was a social disease, what is called class today, the issue of class. So now we had a combination. We have the cultural issue that centers around al-asabiyya. You know what the word, we all Muslims know al-asabiyya. Do I have to explain what al-asabiyya is to you? Al-asabiyya is clannish solidarity. This clannish solidarity, even though Islam had put an end to it in the time of the Prophet through that struggle, and in those first years after that, but it came back. It had a way of coming back during the reign of Uthman. And then now Imam Ali had to deal with this. And when people stand for justice, he stood for al-haq and al-adl. When he stood for this, then these people now who had a sense now of their nationalism, that's the asabiyya. Nationalism is al-asabiyya. And now they had a taste of also class, what it means to be affluent. Muawiyah, when he was given this assignment to go to Damascus, in a sense, a political, you know, today, nowadays, when nation states, they want to appoint ambassadors to different countries, they place something like undesirable people to be far away. This was a good move at the time to have this person away from Al-Hijaz, so that he couldn't stir up this Asabiya. Put him way up there north. Get rid of him, in other words. But what he did was, he acquired this bombastic character that doesn't belong to Islam. And it wasn't hard for him acquiring it, because he was fighting against the Muslims for 20 odd years. It wasn't difficult to do that. And when Umar went to Al-Quds, and Muawiyah was coming to receive him, he saw him wearing this, you know, something and no Muslim would put on. Basically, you know, just like people of protocol today, three-piece suit and looking fancy and tight and chic. Yeah, that's what it was. And Umar did not even want to, Muawiyah says, "Assalamu alaikum," Umar didn't answer him. And then the people said, you know, the people around Omar said, "What are you, he's saying assalamu alaikum, you don't answer." He said, who is this? What type of character is this? The issue is not here issue of character. Sometimes we get stuck on character. The issue here is much beyond. The issue is that there is a social trend. There is a social movement in the opposite direction of Islam. That social movement came to a materialistic arrest when Mecca was liberated by the Prophet. But it didn't go away. It just went underground. And then the first window of opportunity it had, and it saw that first window of opportunity in the time of Uthman, then it tried to break out of this isolation and make its presence known. And that Imam Ali had to deal with that. Now, if we transit from that time, I just hit upon some points. There's a lot of details involved here. Of course, I can't go into a lot of these details. For those of you who follow the khutbahs that are online, I try to cover them in the Jumu'ah khutbahs. We make the transition to the time of Al-Imam Al-Khumayni, Radwanullahi Alayhi, and we see the same thing. We see a radical and revolutionary transformation that set inside a particular culture and society that had its asabiyya, that had its taste of wealth. These elements are there. And an imam, just like the prophet. He's an imam, that's a prophet. We're not saying the imam is a prophet. But just like the prophet, he managed to, at least on the surface of things, defeat these combined forces of class and nationalism. Nationalism is the twin brother of racism. He managed to defeat that. But does that mean it went away? It's gone? No. It was there. What it did, though, just like it did back 1400 years ago, it went underground. It hid itself, waiting for the opportune moment, waiting for a potential Uthman to come along. And if someone like that appears, then we're going to see the comeback, the vicious comeback of these forces. And it's not simple. They're going to argue. They will argue. They will quote the Quran and the Prophet and the Imams to justify their position, to justify their asabiyya, their nationalism, their class status. They'll do all of that. And it's not lacking. They can look, they can take a look, put things out of context, say, yeah, we're Muslims, what are you talking about? Uthman, when the financial corruption in the state administration at his time began, he rationalized it. He said, who tells me I can't give of what I have to my relatives? Where did that come from? Isn't there so much ayat in the Quran about ذوي القربى? So what are you talking about? I'm following the Quran. He had an argument for that. Of course, the argument was out of context, it had no basis, but nevertheless, he made an argument about it. And they can do the same thing today. Give them the opportunity, they will do the same thing. They will establish an argument, quote you some ahadith, some ayat, some quotes from the imams, and there they are. What are you going to do with them? They're going to have power. If they have the power, what are you going to do with them? And if it's not for the Revolutionary Guards and the besieged, you think we would not see Uthman and his equivalents, the Bani with Asabiyya coming back? And those of you, many, I don't know who is and who's not, I know a few of you as I said, but and I'm trying to say this as brotherly as possible. Who here denies the Iranian people, just like all other people, this is not something peculiar to a certain people. The Arabians manifested it 1300 years ago or so, and today it could be manifested by the Iranian people. There's nothing that says they have a feather in their head. Nothing says that. وَإِن تَتَوَلَّوْا يَسْتَبْدِلْ قَوْمًا غَيْرَكُمْ ثم لا يكونوا أمثالكم. And if you retreat, and if you give up on this divine responsibility, on this amana, and this iman, then Allah will pass this responsibility to other people who will not duplicate your behavior. That's as simple as it gets. You want al-asabiyya? You can have it, but you're going to have it at a very, very extracting price. We can learn. We can learn from ourselves. Do we care to learn from history? Or are we going to repeat these mistakes all over again? And instead of, at that time, the Arabians coming along and destroying an Islamic state with their asabiyya, we're going to have Persians coming along and destroying this Islamic state with their asabiyya. You didn't learn? You know, I can see, you know, speaking to Muslims who come from a Sunni background, okay, they really, this is true. They don't want to deal with that history at all. It's the best way out of it is just forget it. So they just don't know. So I can see, you know, if they're going to fall into this mistake again, well, they never bothered to learn. So they're falling into the pit that we fell in the first time. But you're expected to know better. And then if you are expected to know better and you fall into this mistake, al-waylu lakum, woe unto you. However that's said in Persian. Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, I could quote a few names pertaining to the current problem with Asabiyya, but I'm going to leave that to your common sense. I hope you can figure it out. You can tell who is concerned with, I'm an Iranian first and a Muslim second. Or another form of asabiyya is sectarianism. I'm a Shi'i first and a Muslim second. How does that work? That's asabiyya in another form. We are Muslims first. I don't think Imam Khomeini thought about himself except as a Muslim. Of course, he was an Iranian, he was a Shia, no one denies that. And his message was making more, was gaining more ground, making more breakthrough when he was presenting himself as a Muslim first and all of those other issues come later. That was, the appeal was in that. That's when he was appealing to not only Muslims, to the oppressed people of the world. They could identify with him. But when you come and throw these images and sometimes these stereotypes on him, you've isolated him from the potential world that he belongs to. This is what, I'm sorry, this is what some people, and some people think that they're worth doing this is doing exactly the right thing. وَيَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّهُمْ يُحْسِنُونَ صُنْعًا. And they think in doing this that they are doing the best thing that can be done.
قُلْ هَلْ أَدُلُّكُمْ عَلَى الْأَخْسَرِينَ أَعْمَالًا الَّذِينَ ضَلَّ سَعْيُهُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَهُمْ يَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّهُمْ يُحْسِنُونَ صُنْعًا.
And we have this. How are we going to deal with it? It is only the enlightened leadership that we the Muslims have that can see what is taking place and preserve what has been so far accomplished as much as it could with some of the drawbacks that you and I are familiar with. But if, may Allah forbid, if this opens itself up to al-asabiyya, it's going to be self-consumed. It'll go off course, and it will, generations from now, look like, well, in the past, we had an attempt at an Islamic rebirth in Iran, but the elements of asabiyya devoured it. That's how it'll look in generations to come. If you and me are not careful, if we don't know, if our eyes are not open, if we can't identify who is who. And you speak about our common enemies, they love this. This is a dream come true. Why do you think the United States now has, the United States government now has, you can't keep count of them. They keep on reproducing like mice. These satellite stations, they have beamed to Iran. They don't have a fraction of that beamed to China. And China has, population-wise, let's say Iran is 70 to 75 million people. China is 1.3 billion people. Right now, the big scare in the media is Iran is trying to acquire nuclear technology. China has had nuclear technology for, I don't know, we don't know how many years. They're talking about Iran has some oil wealth. China has around $1 trillion, American dollars, in its own treasury, holding it to support the dollar. What if they just got rid of that? The dollar would come crumbling down. Why don't they have 24 or 27 Chinese satellites beaming into China, where the real threat is? And some people just don't want... What you have been listening to in these minutes, some people just say, this is something that should not, why shouldn't it be expressed? Is there, if there's a law in the United States against expressing our mind on the issues of the day, political and whatever they are, if there's a law, tell us where that law is. Where is it? As the last time I checked, we had a constitution that had a Second Amendment that said there's a Bill of Rights that guarantees freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. And then some Muslims here think they are still living somewhere in a tin pot dictator's country where you can't express these things. Is it against? We know the United States government right now is nervous. Why is it nervous? Because the truth is beginning to catch up with it. Before, they used to lie, and then it took about 10 years to figure out, oh, that was a lie. Now, it's not taking 10 years. In about 10 days or 10 weeks, depending on what the lie is, people are beginning to figure it out. So their lies are catching up with them. They don't have that buffer of time that they used to have. They're nervous. Okay, what do you want them to be? You want imperialism to be relaxed? No, I want it to be nervous. You want Zionism to be relaxed? I don't want it to be relaxed. So, you know, I don't know, in this crowd, usually there's one or two bad apples. And they go, and they go and they tell their connections there in the feds or whoever. They tell them, well, this guy spoke about imperialism and about Zionism. And he spoke about Imam Khomeini, and he spoke about revolution. He used these words, so what? No, he didn't speak about that. And if someone's going to come around, I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but if someone comes around and has any concerns about what is being said by yours truly here, refer them to me. Tell them, well, that's it. That's what he said. Go see him. Talk to him about it. Or hang a disclaimer here. We are not responsible for, you know, the opinions expressed in the programs that are held here. If that's, you know, it's going to take you off the hook and you feel more comfortable, just put it back here. So when they're taking that video and the video somehow gets out and gets into these hands, they'll see that disclaimer on the video. And you're free. But I just don't, I mean, Howard Zinn speaks against U.S. Imperialism and Zionism. Chomsky speaks against it. Amy Goodman speaks against it. There's a host of academics and professionals and activists and everyone who speaks against imperialism and Zionism. When it comes to us Muslims, what are we supposed to do? See no evil, hear no evil. Summun bukmun umyun fahum la yafhamun. This is who we are. Can't believe, you know, this slide. We've taken a dip from 25, 30 years ago when this revolution was in its prime to right now, some people thinking that, oh, it's not wise to speak. No, you're not smart. Oh, not smart? Who's the smart person? Oh, the smart person is the one who stays silent. And the hadith says, As-sakitu anil haqq shaytanun akhras. He who remains silent pertaining to al-haqq is a shaytan that can't speak.
Long live Khamenei, takbir!
Allahu Akbar. Now to come to the third segment of this presentation, and that is the Zionist Muslims that we have. This sounds funny. Zionist Muslim, what are you talking about? Well, we're talking about these types of people who are Muslims by their traditions and culture, but who are Zionists by their convictions and ideology. And there's plenty of them, especially when you go up the ladder of power in Muslim countries, and not even Muslim communities. Around here, in the United States, we have these types. I was speaking to one of the brothers. I said that this Annapolis conference that was held, remember, on the 27th of November, a few days ago? The United States put together all its clout and came down on these client states in the Middle East and elsewhere and told them, come to Annapolis. And they came to Annapolis. And there were some people who were demonstrating against this. There were some Zionist Jews and anti-Zionist Jews who were out there in front of the building, the Naval Academy in Annapolis, demonstrating against or for this conference. And one of these rabbis I saw the following day, he said, I was surprised. I didn't see any Palestinians who were attending, you know, who were demonstrating or somehow made their voice known. I said, well, Rabbi, you're doing the right thing. And these other people, they get signals, you know, some Palestinians, some Arabs, some, they get their signals from different embassies and, you know, different power centers, and they follow these signals, and they were not signaled to go to Annapolis. So you have more freedom of conscience than they have, and you're doing the right, I'm saying this to a rabbi, you're doing the right thing. Some Muslims, when it comes to the day of Al-Quds, they say, where are the Palestinians? Is this a Palestinian issue? Is this an issue of asabiyya? He said, I'm telling you, we don't understand our own selves. If this is a Palestinian issue, you just whether you know it or not, you just cast it in an asabiyya configuration. This is not a Palestinian, this is an Islamic issue. If for 1 minute you were to think that the Palestinian issue, if the Muslim public mind was to concede that the occupation of Palestine is a Palestinian issue, we have more or less, we have surrendered this land to the Zionist usurpers and occupiers of Al-Ard al-Mubarak, Al-Ard al-Muqaddasa. It's not. This is an Islamic issue. And Imam al-Khomeini, when he spoke about Palestine, and he spoke about Al-Quds, was he speaking about this as a Palestinian issue? Well, what happened? Either we didn't understand him at the time, and we were just going along because he is an imam, or we understood him, and now that the imam is gone, we have to flow with the currents and the trends of the present. And if these currents and these trends, they give some type of merit to the Saudi government and the Egyptian government and thus the Palestinian Authority and the rest of these imperialist clients in the area, so what does that mean? We are some type of caboose in the choo-choo train of imperialism and Zionism? What defines our Islam, our Iman, is our justice-motivated and justice-centered convictions. If we don't have an obsession with justice, we've lost our Islamic course. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, what's the, I'm going to ask you, I'll answer it, don't worry. What's the dhanb, what's the crime, the sin that Allah will never forgive? Shirk. And what is shirk? Exactly. Allah defines what the shirk is. He says, "Inna shirka la zulmun azim." Certainly, shirk is a an overwhelming or a magnanimous or a grand vulm. You know what vulm is? Injustice and oppression. Inna shirka la vulmun azim. In this world, what's the gargantuan manifestation of vulm? Imperialism and Zionism. Can you have more condensation of vulm, more coagulation of vulm in this world than Zionism and imperialism working together? That is a shirk no one can miss. Inna shirka la vulmun azim. But no, none of us, when the word shirk is used, none of us think about Zionism and imperialism. What happened? What happened? Allah is not going to forgive this shirk. He'll never forgive imperialism and Zionism for what they are. Now, we can break them down. We can talk about imperialism and what it does. How it plunders the resources. How it steals the belongings of other peoples in the world. We can speak about Zionism and how it is racism and all of this. But, to begin with, they have usurped Allah's authority and Allah's power and allocated it to themselves. So they have become competitors with Allah. They've become competing with Allah so much that now we have to factor in the priorities of imperialism and Zionism to the extent that we have to remain silent when they dictate that silence. You tell me that is not vulmun azim. Zionist Muslims. A last word on Zionist Muslims. You know, we have Jews who are Zionists. Somehow, that can be explained in a contorted and in a tortured way. They come to you and they say, "Oh, look, you know, the Jews don't have a homeland in this world, and so they need some place. You know, all these people in the world, they have some land and territory that they live on and they consider their homeland. So why can't this also be the case of the Jews?" And so they try to build this case for Zionism. Of course, they confuse the word homeland with the word nation state. They use the word homeland to appeal to human sympathies and common sense, but they're not looking for a homeland. They're looking for a nation state, for a power center for themselves, and that is the Zionist state of Israel that they have. And then you have the Christian Zionists. And that also has, in another roundabout fashion, its own explanation. They say, "Hey, look, we read the Bible, and God says that He has promised this land to the children of Israel. And so these are the Jews, the children of Israel, so this land belongs to them because the Bible says so." But when you come to a Muslim, where does he get his justification for Zionism and having a peace with the Zionists? Remember when, I don't know if you remember, this was about maybe 14 years ago, there was a drive, remember after the Oslo and all of this, it was a major drive to try to have Muslims agree to some type of peace with the Israeli nation state. And so the Egyptian government comes down on the rector of the Azhar, the head of the Azhar, and they say, "Could you write a fatwa saying that it's all right for Muslims to enter into a peace with the Israelis?" He did it. The Egyptian government says, "Do it." And he does it. How do you describe this type of person? How do you describe, I don't know, I'm curious to know. This past week there was a news item, and I want to know I'm going to tell you what the news item is. But after that, if you've heard of this news item, just raise your hand. That's all I... Because I'm curious to know how many of you have heard of this so that I could know how efficient the media is in trying to filter out some of these developments in the Muslim world. The British ambassador in Egypt last week goes to one of the masjids in Egypt, obviously in Cairo somewhere. And when he enters the masjid, the Muslims there say, "Tala al-Badru alayna min faniyat al-wada'a, wajab al-shukru alayna ma da'a lillahi da'a." You know what was said to the Prophet when he went to Medina. They said this to the British ambassador coming into the masjid. Now, I gave you this news item. How many of you heard it? No one. See how efficient they are in taking away something like this? It should, I mean, to us, it indicates, it tells us a lot. But obviously they know if this news item is going to be flashed to Muslim public opinion, something is going to happen. So keep it away. Don't bring it to their attention. That's how they want us to be. What is this? It's only expressing the truth. Which takes me back full circle right now as to the mission of the Prophet, the mission of an Imam al-Khomeini, and that is simply saying the truth. That's all. The bottom line is you just simply express the truth. Don't bottle it in. Don't postpone it to another year or another occasion. When the truth has to be said, you express the truth. And there's no problem with expressing the truth on many issues around. You can step outside and you can look at a tree that is blossoming and say, "Oh, this tree is blossomed. Look how green." That's the truth. You looked at a tree and said, "No one's going to object to you. Anyone going to object? Can you take me to prison for that?" Obviously not. You can step outside, you can see a 1991 or 99 Mercedes-Benz. And say, "This is 1999 Mercedes-Benz. That's the truth. That's what you saw. Anyone going to object to it?" No. You can express the truth pertaining to some issues in society. Look, downtown there's a street in which there is prostitutes and brothels and all of that. That's the truth. There's a street somewhere. Every city has it almost. And there's brothels and prostitutes in that area. Is anyone going to say anything? That's the truth. You express the truth. But there's an area where you express the truth, everyone is nervous. And that's when you begin to say that a president of a certain country has invaded and occupied another country. And he had no basis for doing that. He was lying. And the people around him were lying. That's the truth. So what? Why is it? Why could I express one truth and I can't express another truth? Has the truth now been subjected to the forces of the market? If it's profitable or if it's workable to say the truth, I'm going to say it. But if saying this truth means that the FBI is going to make a record of it, or I may not get a security clearance, or I may not get promoted, or these other considerations, at that time you can no longer say the truth. Now, this may be understandable concerning maybe a semi-educated person. It may be understandable. But when it comes to those who are expected to pronounce the truth, how can we understand this? When it comes to the ulama, to the scholars, to the followers of the prophets and the apostles, when it comes to them and they don't say the truth, something is wrong. Something is really wrong. And what is wrong with them when you take a very close look at them? What is wrong is they never understood that their mission is to set out and see to it that justice is done. And if the truth is not going to be expressed in its time and in its place, justice will never be done. If our tongues are tied, if our minds are muzzled, if our conscience is crowded with the materialism of this world, then we have failed ourselves, we have failed our leaders, we have failed our prophets, and ultimately we have failed Allah. I hope I didn't get on anyone's nerves. I tried as much as possible to communicate to you some of the ideas that should be, I think, centerpiece in the discussions and in the presentations of Muslims nowadays. And just in case I left some gaps or something hasn't been clarified well enough, I know some of these areas need a little more details, but if that's the case, I'm here to try to clarify any of these points. May Allah forgive us if we've slipped in an area or in a subject, and may He reinforce our convictions if in the bulk of what we have said we have expressed the truth. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Thank you.